All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio. This is Veterans Radio. And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
And good afternoon and welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, CW2 type, United States Army, aviation helicopter type pilot, 1969, Republic of Vietnam. Welcome to Veterans Radio today. We are going to be talking about the VA again, as we've been trying to do now every month. Our last program of each month, we're going to be talking about the VA benefits and some other things that, you know, that are occurring as far as veterans are concerned out there. As you probably remember this last week, which was kind of interesting. They passed a big giant omnibus bill, but they didn't really put any money toward the VA. So, you know, we like to let our politicians know what we think of some of their decisions. So we're going to have some guests on it. We're going to be talking about that in a little bit. I want to thank all of you that participated in our little survey that we put out last week. We got a lot of great responses, and we're going to be talking about some of those later on. Our guests today are going to include Jim Falzone. He's works with Legal Help for Veterans, and also, as you know, he's one of our partners here on Veterans Radio. He puts up a lot of podcast programs on our website, so if you go to our website and hit podcast, find a lot of his programs up there, and also we kind of edit some of them down and put them on the air here on Veterans Radio here, coming to you from the studios of WAAM, Talk Radio 1600 in Ann Arbor, Michigan. As I mentioned, we're going to be talking about that. News of the day is that today is Medal of Honor Day, and today we are supposed to be, we should be celebrating all of the Medal of Honor recipients. There's been a little over 3,400 of them over the years, and in fact, let me get my little information here. Today is National Medal of Honor Day, and the first one was issued on March 25th, 1863. The first Medals of Honor were presented. Secretary of War Edward Stanton presented Medals of Honor to six members of Andrews Raiders for their volunteering and participation during an American Civil War raid in April of 1862. So officially created in 1861, it's the highest military honor for the United States, and it's only awarded to U.S. military personnel by the President in the name of Congress for personal acts of valor above and beyond the call of duty. There are, I didn't know this, there are three versions of the Medal of Honor. One is for the Army, one is for the Navy, and one is for the Air Force. Personnel in the Marine Corps and Coast Guard receive the Navy version of it. And since its creation, as of this particular website, it says that there have been 3,468 Medals of Honors awarded to our country's soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and Coast Guardsmen. So we want to welcome and we want to thank everybody that we know. We've had the honor of talking to a number of Medal of Honor recipients. By the way, for those of you that are not aware, you receive the Medal of Honor. You don't win it. There are no winners of Medal of Honors. You receive it. It's a reward for something that you have done way above and beyond the call of duty. I wanted to remind you that in Michigan, and then this is something that we're working on, there are four living Medal of Honor recipients. There's Dwayne Dewey, United States Marine Corps, Jim McLuhan of the United States Army, and Charlie Kettles of the United States Army. In fact, we had Jim and Charlie on our program last week, so you can go to our archives and listen to our conversation with two recent Medal of Honor recipients. And Robert Simonak is also a recipient of the Medal of Honor, and he's the United States Marine Corps. As a way of observing, our way of observing the Medal of Honor today is that we are going to play a different Medal of Honor segment that we use on our weekly programs every time we take a break. So I think we've got three of them lined up for you today. So I'm excited about that. So we're going to take our first break. When we come back, we've got two guests on, and we're going to be talking about the question that we asked many of you in our Twitter feed and Facebook feed about, do we want to privatize the VA or not? And so, as I mentioned, Jim Falzone will be there. Brian Bradford's also going to be on. He's the senior vice commander of the Disabled American Vet, and he's going to be talking about it. He's got an official opinion, and then he's got his own opinion. And we also want your opinion. So remember those phone numbers I gave you earlier on. So we're going to take a break right now, and we'll be right back to talk about should we privatize the VA or not.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. A father and his son were both awarded the Medal of Honor. Details after this. First Lieutenant Arthur MacArthur was awarded the Medal of Honor for seizing the colors of his regiment at a critical moment and planting them on the captured works on the crest of Missionary Ridge, Tennessee, November 25, 1863. His son, General Douglas MacArthur, was awarded the Medal of Honor for conspicuous leadership in preparing the Philippine Islands to resist conquest, for gallantry above and beyond the call of duty in action against invading Japanese forces, and for the heroic conduct of defensive and offensive operations on the Bataan Peninsula. His utter disregard of personal danger under heavy fire and aerial bombardment, his calm judgment in each crisis, inspired his troops, galvanized the spirit of resistance of the Filipino people, and confirmed the faith of the American people in their armed forces. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
And we're back here on Veterans Radio. That's one of our tributes to the Medal of Honor recipients, 3,400 of them. We're waiting right now for another guest who has just arrived, Michael Smith, who's the director of the Veterans Service Office here in Washtenaw County. He'll be in the studio in a moment. But joining me on the line to talk about the VA and privatization and so forth is my partner, Jim Fausone. Jim, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Dale, good to talk to you.
Okay, we finally got it all squared away. I'll put a pause in there so I can edit that part out. thanks for agreeing to be on the program, Jim. And also on the line with us is Brian Bradford. Brian, welcome to the program.
Well, it's an honor to be here. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And we were talking earlier about the idea of privatizing the VA, and there's a number of options available. And I'm going to ask you, Jim, first of all, what you think some of the options might be, or what you've heard out there through the grapevine.
Well, Dale, it's a good topic because, as you know, it's not only hot in Congress and among the veterans, but we've also this week on Veterans Radio done a Facebook and Twitter poll on this question, and it tells us some things that are maybe a little different than what you hear out of the mainstream press. And we also had a chance this week to talk to a senior behavioral scientist, Terry Tenelian, with the RAND Corporation, who did an extensive survey of New York healthcare, New York State healthcare providers, to see if they were ready to handle veterans' healthcare issues if Congress decided to head in a direction of more privatization. So I think we're ready to talk about both of those subjects.
Right. It is. I do want to get to that article at some point today, Jim. Brian, I'm going to ask you in your official standard position, first of all, with the DAV, to talk about what the DAV's position is on privatization of the VA.
Okay. Well, the challenge with privatization of the VA, when it comes to, like, for example, you're talking about the burn pits, it's a ancillary causes and effects of that one doctor in privatization of that may not be familiar with and may not know to look for issues in regards to lymphoma and things of that fashion, or they might look at something like tuberculosis that maybe. So there's the privatization, and that is has everything to do as far as the DAV's position. And by the way, I'm the senior vice commander for Chapter 125 of Livingston County in Western Oakland County, just to be more specific about
okay.
that title. But that's where the Disabled American Veterans position is on privatization, is that that's one major concern, is the unfamiliarity with some of these nuanced things that Vietnam veterans deal with Agent Orange, or dealing with chemical poison or asbestos, or even it exaggerated the burn pits and the oncoming Fort McClellan poisoning there.
Right. When I was talking to you earlier in the week, Brian, you mentioned that in articles that I've been reading, the original purpose of the VA was only to treat service-disabled veterans. Is that correct?
That is correct. It is their primary focus, but they did kind of expand beyond that. So into general practice and general care of the veterans, and because there is such a ancillary effect of that one caused the other, it's a holistic approach. So from the DAV standpoint, dealing with it from a holistic approach is an issue. Now, privatization, when they're talking about the choice care, is a different issue altogether.
Mm-hmm. Well, before we get into that, I want to welcome Michael Smith into the studio. He's had some business to attend to out there. And so Michael is the director of the Washtenaw County Veterans Service Office and is our, what I like to call as my resident expert on benefits for the VA. Every month we talk with Michael and other people to see if we can help people out. So Michael, welcome back.
Thanks so much, Dale. It's good to join you in the studio as always.
It is. By the way, we do have a question on the phone and I'm not sure where it's going to go, but if you want to put, Curtis, it says, is on the line. So, Curtis, what is your question? Welcome to Veterans Radio.
Yeah, thank you very much. I can only go by me being a veteran and being treated for PTSD. I still haven't received my benefits, but I'm being treated. And I just would feel very uncomfortable not being around other veterans. I realize that if I probably was being treated, you know, in a group environment, there'd be other veterans there, but nothing is like having veterans all around you and being able to relate to them.
Okay, so do you feel like the idea that the VA would have the ability to treat your PTSD rather than a civilian?
Well, absolutely, and the camaraderie of other veterans around you, it just adds that much more to your treatment.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Curtis. And hopefully, we can get that claim of yours taken care of.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, we've had a number
That comment certainly is echoed in the survey data that's out there. That a year ago, Legal Help for Veterans did a survey of its clients. Now, these are mostly disability claimants. But we asked them, do you think VA healthcare should be privatized? And 52% said yes, but 48% said no. And as we look at our survey data from our poll this week on Veterans Radio, I think it's pretty similar. I think there's a mixed message here. It's not 80% one way or the other, but kind of split down the middle that a lot of people see the value of VAs, particularly for treating veterans among veterans and treating veterans for some of those unique combat battle injuries and things like PTSD, MST, TBI. So it's really been a 50-50 call, I think, is what the veteran community is telling us.
Well, that's
I think
go ahead, Brian.
I think if we find, if we narrow that, really kind of bring in the, for example, the PTSD. All right, so military, for those who are not military that are listening to the program, military are trained one of two things, okay? You either have enemy combatants or you have friendlies. And when you don't know who to trust, you trust nobody. And that's one of the reasons it's kind of exponentially caused the veteran suicide issue to kind of bunker down and things of that fashion. Vets only deal with three kinds of people, in my experience, and I've been dealing with it for a long time. Helped implement programs like Reboot Recovery here in Michigan, which was founded out of Fort Campbell, Kentucky, which is a brother-to-brother PTSD recovery program. It's not a 12-step program. But when you look at that, they're only interested in talking to, one, a fellow combat vet, a fellow vet. Number two, they'll talk to a pastor or a priest, and most likely, usually when they're forced to, a psychologist. So when you're talking about that nuance of that particular ailment, absolutely they want to be around other veterans. But I think if you broaden the spectrum of treatment and made that survey question a little more specific, I think you'd find that when you're talking about chiropractic care, when you talk about general health, I think you may have different numbers.
Oh, I agree with that, Brian. I do think it is, a broad survey question that gets, when you narrow it down, it gets a little more in sharper focus. But we had a comment in our survey from Jerry of Modesto, California, who said, I'm 50-50 on this because the VA is beyond FUBAR and might not be repairable. My nearest VA hospital is an hour and a half away, so doing things locally would benefit me better. Regardless, us vets need treatment and care one way or another. And I think that really maybe captures the feeling of a lot of the guys out there.
I could agree with that, Jim. One of the other statements we got is that he just wanted them to answer their phone. So I can relate to that one. We have another caller on the line, and this is Richard. And Richard, you're welcome to Veterans Radio. Your question, please.
Well, I was treated or attempted to get treatment for PTSD 30 years ago and was denied. And as a result, I don't go to the VA. I'm not eligible because of their treatment. I've given up on them. But it's the old catch-22. They say I'm crazy. I say I'm not. Anybody with a VA system that tried to help me was transferred or otherwise punished. Therefore, I do not have anything to do with the VA. The VA cannot be saved. That's my opinion.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that. By the way, you said that you can't get treatment there for anything, or are you just looking at post-traumatic stress?
Well, it's like the doctors look at me. They're looking at my medical records where the last psychiatrist wrote that never saw me, that I was paranoid schizophrenic. Okay? Therefore, I'm not eligible. Any doctor that tries to treat me or help me at the VA has been punished, transferred.
Wow. Well, thank you for filling us out in on that issue, and I'm sure that we will hear other stories like that. But Michael, could you answer that question, maybe?
Well, it all depends on what he's saying here. So if the VA didn't diagnose the condition that a veteran believes he or she has, but they do diagnose another mental health disorder, treatment for those mental health disorders is available. And matter of fact, they have an obligation. Now, whether or not veterans want to choose to get their treatment there, that's a different story. Mm-hmm. And it kind of goes back to what I had told you about some of my claims, where veterans were diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder by civilian doctors, received treatment by those doctors. And then when we filed the claim, the VA examining officials diagnosed bipolar disorder or some other mental health disorder like a stressor-related or unspecified stressor or trauma-related disorder. And then, yes, once that diagnosis was in the record, I had some veterans who were already receiving their health care treatment at the VA, and their doctors or their team of doctors began to treat them for the new diagnosis as opposed to continuing their PTSD treatment.
Is bipolar, that wouldn't be considered a service-connected disability, would it?
Well, so there's one of the things that the examining officials have to do now in the disability benefits questionnaire. There is a question that says, does this person have PTSD, yes or no? Depending on how they respond to that question, then there is another question that says, does this person have another mental health disorder? Mm-hmm. And if they do, then they ask, is it possible that this other mental health disorder is related to the stressors that they identified in their application? Now, I've seen that happen where the examining official says, yes, this person has general anxiety disorder, or this person has bipolar disorder. And yes, I believe it's related to the stressors that they related that happened in military service. So they end up getting service connected. Mm-hmm. And getting disability compensation, but not for the mental health disorder for which they claimed initially, which was PTSD, but rather for the other mental health disorder. But I've also seen it go the other way, where they say, yes, they have bipolar, and no, it's not related to the stressor they related that happened in military service.
I think sometimes it depends on the evaluator. Doesn't know the way it's written up, probably.
Well, I actually, one mental health examiner down at the Detroit VA Medical Center was asked specifically, how did these other three doctors, two civilians and a VA doctor, diagnose this veteran with post-traumatic stress disorder, and you diagnosed an unspecified trauma and stressor-related disorder? Can you reconcile the differences between three against one? The examining official wrote back and said, It comes down to the way the questions are asked and answered. Other than that, I can't reconcile the differences. That was her short, sweet answer to some people running a red flag up and trying to figure out how in the world did three other mental health professionals One in the VA, one was an examining official, and one was a civilian. So they, none of these people were related to each other in any kind of professional regard. So it would seem to me that them being mental health professionals and using the same diagnostic criteria as in all the rest, and coming to a conclusion that the person had PTSD, and then this one doctor coming to a different diagnosis, right. it does make you wonder and make you concerned about what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Brian, I wanted to ask you a quick question. If the VA went to VA healthcare, I suppose we should probably really differentiate the question is, if the VA healthcare went to a choice program, you know, where they just gave us a card and we could go to any doctor we wanted to see anywhere out there, that would not overlap with the disability benefits side of the program, the question, would it? They would still be.
It doesn't appear to be. I mean, your benefits as far as, okay, what did you qualify for? I mean, let me clarify, talk out loud so I can understand the question better. You're talking about, all right, so what's the disability rating versus what the service, those are two separate things as far as the VA is concerned.
Okay, that's what I meant. So if we were to privatize the VA healthcare system, it would, you know, they're not going to necessarily privatize the disability benefits side of that picture.
No, talking about comp and pen, and that area is I have yet to, correct me if any of you guys have heard differently, but I have not heard that part of it talked about in a privatization narrative.
Okay.
Well, currently the VA, at least over the last 4 or 5 years, have used civilian contractors to help them with compensation and pension examinations. We have QVS, Medical Services Incorporated out of Canton. We have Veterans Evaluation Services out of Houston, Texas. And then there's another acronym, I believe it's ITL. So they're currently using three civilian contractors to provide compensation and pension exams, in addition to their own compensation and pension section.
Okay, so they're farming out some of the, because I just had a hearing exam that I had to go to that was an outside contractor, which I thought was rather interesting. But we've only got a couple of minutes to go. Jim, I know I heard you trying to say something there.
I just wanted to pass along another comment from our survey that Veterans Radio ran this week from John from Louisiana, because I think this sums it up for a lot of folks too, which is, he wrote, all the men and women that died didn't die for private corporations. They died for this country, and it's this country's responsibility to take care of their veterans, active and inactive. And I think there's a lot of folks who believe that his comment is on the mark, which is, look, just get it right, provide the care. I think many think that VA should do it. They need to get organized better. They got to answer the phone, as somebody said. But the obligations remains. You can't shuck this off to the country's obligation off to private corporations. That's not what men and women signed up for here.
And at the same time, one of the challenges, a lot of the things that I hear have everything to do with after 4 o'clock services, weekend services, or the, and I grew up in a union household, and I'm not talking to you right now as a member of the DAV, I'm talking to you as a veteran, right? What it has to do in order to be able to get rid of bad apples at the Veterans Administration. The bureaucracy, for example, the 45-day rule. I had a guy come in and he said, I need to go in and get hearing aids. I said, great, go in and talk to him. They asked the question on the phone, hey, had you ever been seen for your ears before? And the answer was yes, but never at the VA. I told him to pick up the phone and call again. And the first time the call, he says, oh, we're going to push you off till August. The second call, he goes, oh, yeah, we got to do it within 45 days because it's first-time treatment. It's that bureaucracy that is probably the biggest narrative of why we're talking about this privatization.
Okay.
It's not the care itself.
Right. I got you. We need to take a break for the news at the bottom of the hour. You can hear the music coming up. Hold on the phone, all of you, please, and we'll be right back. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
Yeah.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. PFC Harold Aggerholm evacuated 45 casualties in 3 hours under heavy fire. Details after this. When the enemy launched a fierce, determined counterattack against our positions and overran a neighboring artillery battalion on Saipan, Aggerholm immediately volunteered to assist in the efforts to check the hostile attack and evacuate our wounded. Locating and appropriating an abandoned ambulance jeep, he repeatedly made extremely perilous trips under heavy rifle and mortar fire and single-handedly loaded and evacuated approximately 45 casualties, working tirelessly and with utter disregard for his own safety during a grueling period of more than 3 hours. Despite intense, persistent enemy fire, he ran out to aid two men whom he believed to be wounded Marines but was himself mortally wounded by a Japanese sniper while carrying out his hazardous mission. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
And we're back here on Veterans Radio. As I said, it was another Medal of Honor segment. We've got one more before we break for the day. We're talking about the possibility or the question of privatizing VA health services. Our guests are Michael Smith here from the Washtenaw County Veterans Service Office. We've got Jim Falzone from Legal Help for Veterans. I've got Brian Bradford's on the line as a civilian. He also works in taking care of veterans claims and so forth up in the Brighton area. And I think joining me on the line shortly will be General Carol Ann Falzone, another veterans advocate that we've got there. Gentlemen, let me ask you the question of, I used to work in health insurance, and the thing that always worries me when I think about the idea of privatizing is the cost factor of providing us with health insurance policies almost. Can any one of you want to address that a little bit? Is this just going to be a government plan, or is it going to be something where we get an allowance and go out and purchase our own coverage?
I think everything that I've read so far is talk about this is a government plan as compared to a stipend to veterans to go buy a private policy, but who knows what Congress will ultimately do.
Sounds like a Medicare thing.
It actually is. That's what the Commission on Care somewhat recommended to the VA, that as they implement or give veterans more of a choice, they wanted to have two offices set up,
right?
One office in the VA Health Administration to oversee Capitol buildings where and the care that veterans are choosing to receive at a VA facility, and then another office that would oversee the health care that veterans are receiving on the economy through the Choice Program, and wanting the vet providers and have a list of authorized providers who agree to receive payment from the federal government, much like the Medicare system. So, you know, it's concerning to me when you look at Medicare and you look at the type of physicians that are providing healthcare service to those people at obviously a reduced rate than what they would normally charge. And you sometimes that old adage, you get what you pay for, comes to mind, and that's a little concerning to me about the health care of our veterans, our nation's veterans.
Brian?
I concur with that. Okay. I think if you were going to give them, I concur with his thought process, is that if you're going to look at it from a Medicare standpoint and that kind of program, you have a reduced amount of real professionals and specialists that would even take it, even in today's society, without even going to that. Looking at the Affordable Care Act, there's a lot of people that have opted out. A lot of doctors have opted out. They've gone to concierge-style services and things of that fashion. Mm-hmm. And they're looking at a diminished talent to serve our veterans, and I don't believe in that.
I agree, Jim.
I think this question,
Dale, this might be a transition to talk about the RAND Corporation report that we're going to put a podcast up for Veterans Radio on in the next week.
That's true. Yeah.
If for RAND Corporation probably sounds familiar to many veterans, we had the opportunity to talk to a senior behavioral scientist, Terry Tenelian, with the RAND Corporation, which is a nonpartisan project think tank. it is the group that issued the Invisible Wounds of War report in 2008 and sort of broke the whole story open that this particular conflict was sending a lot of guys back with TBI issues. So I think they do some credible work. But they went out in New York State and sort of looked at, hey, would you even be ready to take veterans in the private sector? And found that some really interesting things. While most providers have capacity for more clients, most of them, only 20% of the providers were even aware of veterans' choice programs, and thereby only 4.3% actually participated in such programs. So to the extent the VA or veterans for concerned care or others are saying, well, you can go private sector side, there's a real gap, a real fall off in how the private sector healthcare side looks at this. 18% said they were hesitant to refer patients to the VA because of quality concerns. I mean, it's a very in-depth report that we'd encourage people to listen to the podcast with Terry Tenelian from RAND Corporation. And one of the things I found most shocking, and it was mentioned a little earlier, private sector is not aware of the exposures and disease processes that veterans may encounter. Only 16% said that they had enough knowledge to take into account such things as military exposures, whether it be Agent Orange, smoke from burn pits, benzene, uranium, et cetera. So just tossing this over to the private side without a whole lot more education is really not going to be the panacea, and we'd encourage people to listen to the podcast, and if interested, go to rand.org, and you can just search their website for their report, which came out 30 days ago, called Ready or Not, Assessing the Capacity of Healthcare Providers to Meet the Needs of Veterans in New York State. So very interesting scientifically researched data rather than just sort of everybody's reaction to maybe imprecise surveys.
Mm-hmm. And Brian, I like the thing that you bring up and has been repeated. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. But there's a kind of a repeated theme here. So yes, doctors can treat soft tissue sarcomas. Any doctor can treat lung cancer, or any doctor can treat Parkinson's disease or post-traumatic stress disorder. But it's the how. A farmer may have been exposed to herbicides and therefore developed any one of the presumptive conditions that we see on the list of presumptive conditions, for herbicide exposure. But it was how that veteran was exposed is different than the way that farmer was exposed, or how a civilian may be obtained or experienced a trauma and then develop post-traumatic stress disorder, and then how a veteran obtained post-traumatic stress disorder, or a Marine or a spouse of a Marine that was down at Camp Lejeune drinking bad water,
right,
and developed Parkinson's disease. So, you know, it's the how that we came to a particular medical condition that is key to our treatment. And I believe the VA has proven since its existence that they are the ones that are, in a sense, a specialist in that regard. And the National Center for Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder and all the studies that are being conducted by the VA so that they can better serve that very unusual client, that very particular client group that most civilians wouldn't know how to take care of. And I'll be honest with you, there are veterans who always ask me, where can I go and to see a civilian to get treatment for my post-traumatic stress disorder? And it's very, 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 very limiting. There are a lot of mental health professionals out there that just do not know how to go about the diagnostic approach to even diagnosing PTSD, much less treating it.
Absolutely. You know, the getting by the idea that post-traumatic stress is a permanent thing, it can't be fixed. I alluded to earlier a program called Reboot Recovery. It was founded out of Fort Campbell, Kentucky. It is being run right now in three different locations and expanding out to East Lansing, and we're looking for ways to move that into different areas as well. This is a program, it's a vet-to-vet recovery program, and it's had great success. Over 2,000 people put through that program so far, not one suicide since. But I agree wholeheartedly with you. It's how it happened and they want to deal with other vets because there's a comfort there. It's like, I know you put the uniform on, you knew I put the uniform on, and a lot of it has to do with also, I got to say, my opinion is that it has a lot to do with bureaucracy. Look at University of Michigan Hospital versus the Veterans Administration. Same cardiac care unit at U of M, same cardiac care unit, does 10 times as many surgeries on a monthly basis as the one at the VA. Same, the reason why is because that unit has to be sterilized by 4:30 in the afternoon. They can't function in the same fashion. It's not a level playing field. But if it was, we could have the same care. And in that particular case, we have privatized that particular area of the VA system.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
I think we only have three lines here. Is that correct? All right. Jim, I'm going to have to let you go because I'm going to bring your wife on.
Absolutely. I know who the general is. And I just want to encourage everybody to go to veteransradio.net, hit the podcast button, and listen to our podcast, including the one on Rand Corporation.
Absolutely.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you very
much,
Jim. That was Jim Falzone from Legal Help for Veterans. And joining us on the line right now is retired Air Force General Carol Ann Falzone. Carol Ann, welcome.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. As you can tell, we've got a nice little lively discussion going on here about the idea of replacing or fixing the VA health system. And Brian just brought up an excellent point, is that, you know, we're very fortunate here in Ann Arbor because we've got a major university hospital, you know, across the river. And, you know, the doctors go back and forth. But as Brian pointed out, you know, they can do, you know, five or six surgeries in a day where the VA can maybe only do two. And I'm not sure how we can fix that problem. And I guess my question would be right now is if we had a perfect world, how would we correct what's going on at the VA, or do we just get rid of the VA? That's my yes or no question. So, Caroline, I'm going to go to you first.
Well, I really believe there needs to be a hybrid. It's like saying throw the baby out with the bathwater, and I don't believe that's true. But there are many things that need to get fixed, and somebody needs to listen, and I think that's a part of the problem with the VA. And Brian's example is spectacular because I'm a nurse, and I understand that, and you want the experts. You don't want somebody at the VA, and I have assisted in getting somebody to go to like a University of Michigan versus receive their surgery from a doctor who's maybe done 100 versus a physician who has done thousands of a procedure.
Right.
So I think we need to look at the best way to take care of a veteran. Now, I think it was Michael, and I think he's exactly correct in saying there's not a lot of individuals out there who are experts sometimes when they're treating a physician. But if we were more direct in a consult and considered not either you do one or you do the other, and we do a combination of saying, okay, you've got a specific liver disease or a pulmonary disease, and there's a physician out there that is the expert. Let's get a consult. Let's get it back. And then be able to do a disability. We're seeing more and more, like in the case with you, you said you went to a contractor for your exam, hearing exam. Well, if you had to wait for the VA, it might be 8 months, a year in waiting versus you went down the street.
Right.
You made it very convenient for you. You got a report. It goes back to the VA, and they're able to make a decision on your disability. I wish we had more of that in a lot of different areas, and we start to build on a hybrid.
Do you think is there a competition level going on here, or is there just a lack of communication between? I think we're very fortunate here in Ann Arbor, only because I've had friends who have had serious health issues, and the VA referred them to U of M to do surgeries and so forth.
I want to give you a good example. I've been told by several directors of the VA, not presently Robert McDermott regionally, but I've been told by several that they didn't want to literally privatize or contract out to different groups originally, and I still was serving when the TBI issue was really rearing its ugly head. And the comment was, we don't want to give away the farm. This is our bread and butter. And my belief was, let's not build facilities. In Michigan, we had all these physicians that to go out and contract with and assist us in making those decisions. And so I was told they don't want to give away the farm. But I think the farm is really going downhill.
I think that's a question that I got from, where did I get this one from? Concerned Veterans of America, I think it was. And the question was, won't offering veterans the choice to get private care outside the VA inevitably lead to the collapse of the VA healthcare system by causing most veterans to leave the system? Any comments on that? Brian, I'll ask you first.
Well, the disabled American veterans, and I agree with this, I've heard the same from everybody to talk. There's a area within the Veterans Administration in dealing with vets that is really kind of their bread and butter. And I wouldn't say so much their bread and butter is that they have more experience with it. They have more experience with spinal injuries, more experience with the rehab, integration, things of that fish. And they have more experience with PTSD. They have more experience with TBI. We send people out to the Eisenhower Center, for TBI as well. Right. But one of the things that's missing is craniosacral therapists. And the VA hasn't adopted that yet, but I've seen incredible results with guys with TBI going to see craniosacral therapists that have had an immense amount. So I think if we kind of like maybe just kind of look at the really what's the things that the Veterans Administration is the greatest at, and we started with that, but there's other things like chiropractic care, hearing care, and things that eye care, a lot of that nuanced stuff, right? Could be easily contracted out and really kind of give the VA an opportunity to refine and stay within their wheelhouse and be really good at that particular area.
Well, hey, Brian, this is Carol Ann. You know what? You couldn't have used a better example, and I'm going to tell you, I really was very vocal with this. I know probably 10 to 12 paralyzed veterans that would stand behind me. We tried to get the regional paralyzed veteran spinal cord right here in Detroit, and they ended up going to Indianapolis and telling us they're going to build a brand new facility when you've got facilities like RIM and a University of Michigan. And when you're asking our paralyzed veterans to get in a car and either drive to Cleveland or Chicago for care, I just think that's ludicrous. I mean, they are already stressed enough with all that's going on with them to have to drive hours to get care when it's in our backyard.
Absolutely.
I think we all say absolutely about things like that. And I think that's probably one of the main issues as to what we can do to fix the VA is, as you know, the specialties that they do have. I think if somebody is paralyzed, then we need care that's closer. If somebody's got a hearing problem, we can go to anybody for that. That's not something that's important or that time consuming and so forth, where we need a specialist for. But I think that the VA does have some of these, specialists for, you were mentioning the paralyzed veterans. I was thinking of the prosthetics and the missing limbs and so forth that are so prevalent in today's warfare that I don't know how, I know the civilians in many inner city hospitals might, be experienced with gunshot wounds, but they're not going to be experienced with blow up Humvees and cars and so forth.
Right. We also have to look at from a fiscal standpoint. I'm trained as a financial analyst. Okay. That's what I got out of the service. They sent me back to school, got a degree in corporate finance. So we're looking at, you have somebody that's traveling from the UP, Jackson, Saginaw, wherever it might be. All right. And they're traveling to the VA in Detroit. They're traveling to, Battle Creek, they're going to Ann Arbor. We're paying them for mileage. We're paying them for that process as well. is it fiscally, has someone looked at the fiscal responsibility and said, is it more beneficial from a cost standpoint to have that person treated maybe in Flint or Grand Rapids or like Caroline was talking about? It's that aspect is a totally different area that we look at and say, okay, well, are we really looking at the best? Or are we looking at, is it just going to be, we have to keep it all in-house?
Well, I think the idea of the cost factors obviously has to come into play, because if you are sending somebody from, you know, the UP to the Cleveland Clinic or something along those lines, unfortunately, there are great parts of this country that don't have VA hospitals every 100 miles, and it's just one of the facts about it. You can't have a VA hospital every, you know, five or six of them in each state. It's just, it's physically or feasibly, it's possible, I guess, but it's not financially doable. I know that's why they have so many of these out clinics, but again, the clinics are not for the major things. I'm dumbfounded. I don't know exactly what to do with the issue of the VA hospital. I mean, I truly love what we've got here, and it seems like it's well run and so forth. But then we're reading in the papers right now where the VA in Washington is just, it's a zoo. It's a foobar like we never even imagined, when, you know, the secretary of the VA is having issues, and the people under him want him gone, and the people above him want him gone, and it's taking a toll, I think, on everybody's confidence in the VA in general. Any comments?
I will make this comment, and this is my personal. When our secretary was elevated, he happened to be the undersecretary at the time when all of the issues were being disclosed, you know, out in Phoenix and the other areas. And so I know he's a physician. He's run major corporations. I was very surprised when he was elevated to become our secretary. Mm-hmm. That was a concern for me, because it was, he should have addressed a lot of those issues as undersecretary. And I didn't see that happen. And now some of the individuals are still there. They have been moved to other positions. Yes, some people have been allowed to retire. But I think it's a major issue that someone needs to get in there that understands the system. I said this a couple times last week in talking to other ROs around the country, that they do not have a concept or an idea of what's happening to us in the field. Mm-hmm. When we send stuff to the evidence intake center and we're told it's going to be up and uploaded in 48 hours, I said to one individual last week, you've got another thought coming. Our average is 3.5 months before a document gets uploaded. So I think they're not dealing with reality. That's my perspective.
Well, it's a suggestion is that we kind of clean house at the Department of Veterans Affairs and kind of start over again.
Well, one of the things that the secretary implemented last year was this disciplinary approach, and there you can even go to a place on their website where they announce the position of the person that was either terminated or disciplined, and then what type of discipline they received. And there was over 2,700 and some odd names on that list the last time I checked, and it's updated quarterly. So there is this idea that the secretary was trying to deal with poor performance, and it was across all administrations. It will show you the position name, which administration, whether it was the Veterans Benefits Administration, the Veterans Health Administration, or even the National Cemetery Administration, and then what the particular outcome was. In most of those cases, it was termination. Others were 14-day suspensions or 3-day suspensions without pay. So there is an effort, at least it looks like there's an effort on the VA's part to deal with poor performance and to deal with their image problems. But I don't see it getting any better, especially with the secretary being embroiled with people inside his own administration that want to see him gone, people outside of the administration that want to see him gone. He still has the confidence of the president, at least that's what we know from most recent reports. But it certainly doesn't look good. And and it's not allowing the VA to do its mission.
Well, I know we can't solve the problems because we've only got about 2 minutes left today. And Brian, I'm going to give you about 30 seconds. What do you think we can do to fix what's there now?
I think we really need to have some checks and balances put in place. I mean, things like, for example, when they put in the new wing of the VA in Ann Arbor, they forgot to hook up the hot water to the ICU on the fourth floor. There needs to be some means and measures. You can't just move the chairs on the Titanic and expect it to go transferring people around. Mm-hmm. It's great that we're making moves to actually discipline in people. That's one thing, but we have to run this like a business, a corporation, not like a governmental entity, in order to be more efficient and be able to serve more. And I think we need to refine what it is that the VA is doing and take those things that can be done, and things like that, like ear hearing and nuanced things like that, and push them outside the VA to really kind of narrow the focus of what it is we're doing. And that's less room for error and more room for focus.
Okay. Carol Ann, you got a minute.
I would love consistency. I would love right now for me and with our legal help for veterans to have consistency across the country. I think every RO is running differently. There is no consistency. And to have people be held accountable. I just was told the other day from one RO, not Michigan, that, they've gone to a new standardized process, that when you get a rating decision, you're going to get all of the pieces to the puzzle. Well, I got a page 3 of the puzzle, no page 1, 2, and none of the other results, and that's really difficult to deal with when I'm seeing all this inconsistency.
All right.
So let's start at the top. Let's start developing some things and have it be consistent across every RO.
Okay, I gotta cut you off.
I know you gotta go.
I gotta go. I'm sorry, Michael.
Well, I agree with General Fasson as far as on the Veterans Benefits Administration side of the house. I'd love to see some consistency in the way they approach rating claims and promulgating claims and getting the workload out in the hospitals. I'd like to see more access to care.
Okay.
And yes, I'd like to see veterans get the care that they deserve.
All right, we won't solve the problem this week. Maybe next month we'll talk about it again. So thank you all very much for being on the program today. We will be back at the end of April with another program on the VA and benefits, and maybe some new ideas and benefits that are available to people. Until then, you've been listening to Veterans Radio. You are dismissed.